of total portfolio performance. It should be Bob and Marty.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Unless they changed to something else.
Right.
It works well to sit here, but the there's a computer that your knees run into.
Excuses. Are you complaining?
No, it's better. There used to be a computer here. And
you never complained when you were actually working. Now.
He works.
I work.
Yeah. Well, good morning. I've passed out a flash report to you, and I'll begin by discussing the watch list, talk about asset allocation, and then manager performance. And please interrupt with questions at any time. In terms of the market in the first quarter of the year, it was somewhat mixed. There's concern about slowing growth in China, how the Federal Reserve will taper down their purchase program, and some markets were a bit mixed. The S&P was up 1.8% in the first quarter. The Russell 2000 small stock benchmark was up 0.8%. Consumer discretionary was the only sector in the U.S. market that wasn't up in the first quarter. Utilities were up over 10%. Utilities are essentially perpetual bonds, so it's a flight to safety sort of period. Value outperformed growth in both the large and small cap sectors of the market, and large cap outperformed small cap. In the bond market, the Barclays aggregate gained 1.8% in the first quarter. In the international markets, the MSCI EAFE index, the Europe, Australia, Far East index, was up 0.7%, and emerging markets were down 0.4%. So year to date, as of the weekend, and there's been some volatility since then, but that's when I put together my notes here, S&P is up 2.4% for the year. The Barclays Aggregate Bond Index is up 2.6% so far this year. MSCI EAFE is up 1.8%, and emerging markets are down 1.1%. So the trends have essentially continued. So there are pros and cons, as there always are. Income growth is relatively weak. Unemployment is still high. Corporate earnings growth is slowing down. And the Ukraine crisis creates uncertainty. And whenever there's uncertainty, people stop buying, and that hits markets. On the good side, new claims for unemployment are at a seven-year low. Household net worth in the U.S. is at an all-time high. And at the end of the quarter, the stock market is up 208% from the bottom in 2009 and 38% above a high from 2007. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, you said household income is at a net all-time high?
Net worth. So real estate makes a big difference. The real estate markets have come back. Yeah. Income's not there yet.
I wouldn't say that, but
people don't feel it. They don't feel like we're at an all-time high.
I can see an improvement, but if you take it in a historic viewpoint and add in real estate, is there any kind of indexing or whatever you do to make it comparable to maybe like 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Do they do that in your field?
Well, they don't subtract inflation.
Okay.
I don't think it's subtracted from this number. And the stock market's done well, so folks with those sort of investments have done well, including their IRAs and other retirement assets. And then real estate's recovered for the most part, depending on the area of the country.
So certainly, it's not like an average of everybody and doing it. It's just that we're at a high given where we were.
And it's definitely not correlated to employment rates, because unemployment is still high, or income, because that hasn't come back.
Sounds like the upper 1% has done well, Marty.
Yeah,
I think they've done especially well. Yeah. There's been a divergence there. Yeah.
Used to be 2%, right?
Yeah. But their day is coming, because we really need inflation. You know, that's the debt is a real problem. The UNSD is inflation, and inflation hurts bond values and hurts stocks values, and it helps housing values, which most folks have, and so it's a great tax on the wealthy, if you want to think about it that way. And they can't vote it down.
Wouldn't deflation hurt them even more?
Yeah. Depends how they position their portfolio. But yeah, deflation would hurt everyone. That would be very bad. Very, very bad. So looking at the total fund results, the plan was up 2.7% in the March quarter, and that puts the fund value at $6.5 billion. The manager watch list is on page 3. Actually, it begins on page 2.
Page three.
Yep. Atlante is on the watch list for performance. Their performance has recovered quite a bit. They had a challenging April, so I don't think it's quite the moment to take them off the watch list yet. But at the end of March, they're ahead of their benchmark for the last 5 years.
If you turn to page 17. And it's about three quarters of the way down the page, you can see that the recent performance has really been good. 34th percentile in the 3 months, third percentile in the year, 38th over the 2 years. So the last 2 years has pulled up the relative numbers. The ancient numbers from 7 and 10 years still look lousy, but they're really pretty much right at the median over 5 years. So they're pretty close to coming off the watch list. And
What is the criteria then for deciding that they do come off? How much further?
Well, certainly if you were ahead of the index and ahead of the peers over 5 years, it'd be a slam dunk. 3 years and 5 years, and they're almost there. That would really be the one of the criteria. You're free to take them off. You'd not put them on with these kind of numbers, so we'd be comfortable with it coming off or staying on with another quarter.
A side note to that, I read this, I said, what do I? And I look at what's happened over the last year. We put somebody on the watch. I look at what happened to them over the last year. If I really see some improvement, and it improves the 3 and 5 year, I'm in favor of taking them off watch. I note that their 10 year number is just atrocious. I'm hoping that improves. And I was going to recommend taking them off watch, but your flash says they're what, minus 7% for the last month and minus 1.9 ain't so bad, but go ahead.
That's gonna if you come back next quarter, they're not gonna look as good probably. So
yeah, that's
so you have this whole conversation next quarter and they're gonna be below on everything. So
yeah, what we're really looking for is the improving trend. If the trend is consistent with our expectations, no surprises, they come off watch. Rusty, to your point, there's not a specific metric that says, you know, if the performance hits this number, they come off watch. It's a judgment call that the Milliman comes in. Are things improving? Are things meeting expectations?
Where are you?
Everything says we should bring them off watch except for this April flash, which quite frankly looks like an error to me, but let's get that confirmed before we do anything.
Well, you mentioned improving trend, and that to me means you are measuring something. I'm just wondering again. You said 3 to 5 years, where they're both above the peers and the index, is when you start to feel good about taking them off. And so I'm going to take that as the way you would decide. Maybe we should decide if and when we take off Atlante and anybody else for that matter. Is if they're improving, they have a trend of 3 to 5 years above both the index and the peers, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and if you go back 5 years, it's right on the benchmark. The one thing you might point out on the 10-year number is they're actually above the index, but they are not doing very well compared to the peers. So the peers, this is one case where active managers, at least before fees and after fees actually, have done better than the index.
Are there any consequences to us by leaving firms on the watch list, particularly here, like in a marginal case? In other words, from an audit perspective, from from someone looking at the fund's performance. If we leave people on watch who arguably shouldn't be there, does that nick us up in any way that's discernible?
I don't think so.
The watch list is a board tool. Policy says somebody can go on watch for organizational reasons, for personnel reasons, for performance reasons. The board's responsibility is to revisit that on a quarterly basis. Are we happy when you take them off watch? Is there a level of concern they remain on watch? It's the gray area. It's the we're concerned. We're going to give this heightened scrutiny.
Right.
But we're not seeing a reason here to terminate.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, so if we had a situation where we had like 10 entities on watch, I mean, what's that say about us, is what I'm getting at.
Gray area in the portfolio.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is one, I mean, if someone arguably shouldn't be on watch, I guess I'm wondering why we have them on watch.
On the other hand, though, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Actually, it was Jerry and then me and then you.
I'm done.
My take on that is my take on it is that the company that we put on watch, it's known that we've put them on watch. And if you keep them on watch, I think if they deserve to be off or they're very close to deserving to be off and we keep them on watch, we're hurting their chances for more business and we're hurting their chances to improve. And I've heard that, and I know what's his name that runs Adelante.
Torres.
Yeah, I heard Torres say 6 months ago, being on the watch kind of hurts him down the road, and so that's another thing that's one of the things that can happen. But again, maybe that's what we want too. At times, we want to, especially when we first put somebody on the watch, we want to let people know that we're not happy, and they know we're not happy. So it has an effect on what they do to improve their numbers. So it's a double-edged sword, but the other side of that sword was it can hurt their business
down
the road.
Yeah, there's a consequence to that.
Yeah.
I was going to, even though it's a board tool, because it's public, that's the reason that it is hurting them? I just want to make sure I understand that.
No. Future development of new customers.
Exactly, because if the customers see that they're on our watch list, they're going to
See they're on our watch list because this is a public document that, notwithstanding it's a board tool and intended for that, also finds its way into the public.
Yes, okay. Yes.
And if someone is competing for business and the whispered conversation from the competitor is, well, these guys are on watch, it comes across.
Trustees comments. When you're at a conference and trustees are talking about who they work with or who they don't work with and what's going on, those things
The big argument for not taking them off watch is the flash report is very preliminary. We ask the managers what their performance was, and it's not based on custodial statements. It's a tricky number, as Tim said. There's some. It's surprisingly poor, so it may be somebody gave us a bad number. But if that number is correct, you're going to come back next quarter, and the comparisons are going to be look much worse, and you're going to say, well, why did we take them off watch? So that's the reason to leave them on watch.
And that's my point. I don't want to take them off if we're going to have to put them back on. I'd rather leave them on for another quarter. You can vet these numbers, and then maybe we take them off. I mean, and I'm not hearing a recommendation from our professional staff, so having heard this conversation, I'm sure they'll come back to us with a recommendation.
The information we have at hand causes questions, and I'd like to follow up on that.
Rusty, you did.
Well, no. Jerry said it.
Okay.
That's what I was thinking, too.
Okay.
Thanks, Jerry.
Deborah, did you have
it? Well, I was going to ask Tim's opinion, and we just
he
got
just
it.
Got it.
We had a new piece of information in the room that raises a question, that's all.
Yeah, and I will say that when I first read this, I was thinking of removing them, and then, like I said, I saw your watch list, and I went, ooh, do I or do I not want to? So.
It's in that gray area.
Okay. I'm not perceiving that there's a desire to move forward on taking them off the list, so.
Okay. Lord Abbott is on the watch list for a change in personnel, and that their performance has been fine. There have not been subsequent personnel changes other than the ones we discussed before. I would guide you to leave them on for another quarter. I have no strong feeling there, but performance is fine. But
yeah.
Do we have any update on the personnel changes, how that's going, if you talked with them?
I've talked with them. The concern was that the personnel changes were going to cascade through the investment team. There's been a couple of lower-level changes that Milliman has brought to your attention. There's been nothing of substance. It's not to slight the people who have left, but they were more mid-level folks. It feels like things are settling down there. I'm more than happy to let it go one more quarter to confirm that. It's only been a couple of months at this point.
And I'll go back to what I said earlier. Usually when we place somebody on watch, we wait probably about a year. And they were put on in October, and it hasn't quite been a year. So I'm in favor of just waiting one more quarter and then taking a look. And if the numbers are the same after that time, I'm in favor of doing it.
So I just want to mention, I was at the site visit that we did last year with yeah. Lord Abbott. And if there was support to take them off now, I'd be in support of that, or leave them another 3 months. I didn't really feel that I felt there were good explanations for the personnel changes when we visited.
Well, if I remember correctly, the reason that the personnel changes were going on is that they were more focusing on retail rather than on
I think that was an interpretation.
Public funds, and I talked with people that left and said that
as did I.
Okay.
The other, I was also at the site visit, so I guess the other observation I would make is part of the reason for the concern was the element of surprise. That is, that we really weren't provided notice of what were material significant changes. And I'm listening to Tim say we should let that play out another quarter and just make sure that the changes didn't have any systemic effect. And so far, so good. But I think part of it was the element of surprise. So
it certainly was communication.
Right.
There was a lapse in communication there. That was communicated to them. That's improved markedly since then.
Okay.
My concern is not necessarily the operational folks who left, because that doesn't necessarily directly impact our portfolio. The concern was Rob Lee, our portfolio manager,
right.
took on responsibility for the entire team, mm-hmm. the new role for him. It was a potential distraction away from our portfolio for him. That was what we flagged as the primary concern. To date, we haven't seen a negative impact on that.
Just one last thought. Putting somebody on watch for staff changes, I think, is a good idea. But I think ultimately what we were concerned about was deterioration of performance as a result of the staff changes. And so I think it's worth at least acknowledging that we haven't seen what we thought might be possible, and that was a deterioration in the performance as a result of the staffing change. So if our primary concern really was losing some performance, I'm feeling better about that. So I'm ambivalent. I'd be happy to support, even though I wouldn't be voting today, taking them off watch.
You want to move to take them off watch?
I probably would just heed to Tim's suggestion that we go another quarter.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's our recommendation.
Okay. So both our Tim and our advisors recommend no change at this point. There's not strong desire on the part of the board to change. So moving right along.
Next, Nogales, which I think we're all familiar with, is going to be on the watch list until it lines down. And PIMCO was put on the watch list in February, and it was not included in this list. So I just wanted to be sure to note that. It wasn't formally written into the report.
And I can't recall, was that for performance or personnel changes?
It's really performance has not been ideal most recently, but it was really Mohamed Alarian's departure.
Okay, he's
and so it was really, really personnel.
But the long-term performance still looks good.
Right, but to Jerry's point, that
material personnel change, the concern is ultimately that it would affect performance.
Right.
So just, I want to make sure that the minutes reflect that PIMCO should be on the watch list, and it's not in the report that will become the permanent
rate. We'll get a revised copy of the report.
Yeah. I agree.
Would you like, we'll send you a PDF.
Yes.
We'll have to do it.
Yeah.
A file, a couple of file copies.
Should I move on to asset allocation? So on page 10 and 11, we have the asset allocation versus targets. And you're slightly underweight U.S. fixed income, but you're actually quite close to targets. And cash flows in and out should keep you there or close. So that's not an issue at all at this time. Page 14 is the performance for the overall portfolio and for the managers. And so for the overall portfolio, you're up 2.7% in the first quarter, and that's better than the 2.4% benchmark performance and also better than the 1.6% median public fund. And so for the quarter, you rank in the second percentile, so better than 98% of your peers, which is terrific. And going back over time, you rank in the top third all the time, and for the last 10 years in the top 1%. So terrific results.
Knock on wood.
Yeah, trying to keep that ball rolling. Looking at categories, domestic equities were up 1.9%, so close to the Russell 3000 benchmark's gain of 2%. And better than the median domestic manager, which is up 1.8, and it puts you in the 48th percentile. And I just like to highlight managers that are deviating from their benchmarks. So Ceradex in Delaware had difficult quarters relative to their benchmarks, but if you go out a year or even two, they're ahead of their benchmarks by quite a bit. So this is really, it's a short-term volatility. Emerald did really well in the quarter. However, in April, they had a challenging quarter. And so... Month.
Probably and May too.
What's that?
Probably May too.
I spoke with them yesterday, so I don't have May results, but I did get to understand what was happening. Primarily, it was technology stocks and biotechnology stocks.
And small.
They were down 8.6%. Their benchmark is now 5.1% for April. So. But in a very short term, these things bounce around a lot. It's a small cap stock portfolio. They're very volatile in the short term, so long term perhaps too. In international equity, William Blair underperformed in Q1. They're down 0.4% compared to their benchmark, which is up 0.3%.
Marty, could you speak up a little bit?
Sure. William Blair underperformed in Q1. They were down 0.4%, and their benchmark was up 0.3%. But they've been very consistent outperformers over time. So it's likely a one-quarter volatility issue. In global equities, the global equities overall returned 1%. So very close to the benchmark, MSCI ACWI, which is up 1.1%. The low volatility managers, First Eagle and Intech, which had challenges. Yes, go ahead, Jerry.
Go ahead. You're working down towards it. I have a question about somebody. Go ahead.
Yeah, First Eagle and Intech did very well. This is a market where they would excel, and they're low-vol managers. Last year was not, so this is their time to shine. So First Eagle outperformed by 2.2%. Intech outperformed by 1.6%. But it was a tougher quarter for Artisan and J.P. Morgan. When you put them all together, you're very close to the benchmark for global equities.
J.P. Morgan's investment process... Is it not in favor right now? One of the things I did when I did this is I looked at anybody that was over 50%. I marked if they're more than 50% below, and then I marked it just to see. And they came. I mean, I've got blue marks all the way across my page on them for every year and every quarter. And I like J.P. Morgan, but I'm wondering: are they in downturn right now with their investment process, or is there something we should be aware of?
Well, one thing you should always keep in mind is look at the most recent results, and the last quarter was 90th percentile.
That's
so that
means
that pulls everything else down. If you look at the 1 year, the 2 year, the 3-year. If you throw out the last quarter, they're probably median or above.
All right.
So it's
all right. So it was a one-quarter big hit, and let's look at it. Okay.
Yeah, and that colors all the others. But they've been very consistent and actually quite good.
Okay. So one, I should have gone back and looked at the previous book, and then I would have felt better about it. But I just went, oh, wow. You know, thank you.
Yeah, and also the year period by period, the year by year is helpful, because if you just have one very bad quarter, the most recent one, it pulls down the 5-year performance too, because it's from this point back 5 years. It's a rolling 5 years.
But we're still looking at 77th percentile at 4 years. I mean, I would think that even one bad 90.
Yeah, they didn't get off to a great start either.
And versus the benchmark, they've done quite well. Versus their peers, the benchmark. I mean, there's a peer universe and a benchmark, and they're different. Mm-hmm. And so they look great compared to their benchmark, and then versus the peers.
If you look at last quarter, they were 37th percentile over the first quarter measured, which was the September to December, 46th, 35th, and 55th over 3 years, which is the longest it went, because they've just hit the four-year mark. So that gives you an indication of what that 90th percentile quarter did to them.
Mm-hmm.
On to fixed income. So fixed income did very well. Domestic fixed income was up 2.1%, slightly better than their benchmark, which is the Barclays Universal of 2%, and better than 2% for medium managers. Lord Abbott did well, despite being on our watch list. They were up 2.5% compared to their benchmark at 1.8. And Allianz did well. They're up 2.7 compared to their 3% benchmark. They were slightly under the benchmark. For global fixed income, Lazard underperformed their benchmark. They're up 1.8, but their benchmark is up 2.4. And it's been a challenging period most recently for them. And as I spoke to them, one of the biggest factors was not owning Japanese bonds. They look at Japan and see lots of structural issues. They are now, I think, selling more adult diapers than children's diapers. It's a very demographically challenged society. And they basically don't want to own them, but it's a big part of their benchmark. So when Japan starts recovering, they stimulate the economy, you have an 18% piece of your portfolio in your benchmark that you don't own. And so that's a challenge. So I think that they're right in the long term. They're going to look bad. Have that trade-off. And as long as whatever they haven't purchased instead of Japanese bonds doesn't do better, because it's really relative performance.
Do you mean, I want to make sure I'm hearing you, that they've got a population that's a young population and an aging population?
It's mostly aging.
More aging.
Yeah, it's a very, very aging population.
The Japanese population in general is an aging population. Okay.
Yeah.
And that impacts. Yeah. I thought you meant by that.
Yeah.
In a seismically active zone.
Yeah.
They are. They have an earthquake about every other week there.
Are you still talking about the need for adult diapers?
Well, there is some linkage.
I haven't figured that out.
Your connection there?
He's trying to make one.
Maybe. Reproducing, which is an interesting, unlike their sister country, China. Well, no, they're not either.
No, they're China's got a demographic issue, too.
Yeah.
Because of the one China policy.
Yeah. Excuse me, you were talking about Lazard.
Yeah.
That, right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was Lazard that I just wanted to understand what was driving it, and that was, if there's a single driver, that was the biggest driver, and it's 18% in the benchmark and none in the portfolio, and so whatever you substituted for that 18% do better than the Japanese bonds, and the Japanese bond, the stimulation of the Japanese economy has pushed them up, and so. That's the story behind their most recent challenge. It's not dismal performance, but it's under benchmark performance.
So if the rest of your peers, though, have all made the investment in Japanese bonds and you haven't, do you? I know it's easy to rearview mirror and judge these folks, but I mean, do you second guess them? Do you look at what they did in place and instead of that, and decide if it's a good idea or a bad idea?
it's always easier in retrospect to decide what they should have done, right? But right. When you're sitting there, it's a very hard decision to make. But it's a challenge because you have to make some bets. And if you're making bets versus benchmarks, because in this world, we're going to judge them versus a benchmark, a retail investor might just say, how much money did I make? But we would have a different criteria for that. If I don't look very much like my benchmark, every way I look different is a risk. And so you'd have to look at what bets have I substituted for Japan. If I don't have something that's going to do better, then I made a mistake.
So it's the risk-reward trade-off, though. Even though everywhere you look different from the benchmark is a risk, it's also a place to have potential reward.
Potentially, yeah. Right. And this is the same thing that really caused GMO to not be in our portfolio anymore. As I spoke with them, I said, well, you were really underweight financial stocks last year. And they said, and that really hurt you. 2% of your performance was not there because you didn't own as many financial stocks as in your benchmark. They said, well, we hate financial stocks. We think there's lots of risk there. I said, well, there's a lot of risk if you don't own them, too. If you owned exactly the stocks in the benchmark, you don't have any risk. But you have to make bets to make out performance. And you were short financials versus your benchmark. And they look at me funny and say, no, you were. You were underweighted. So making your bets very intentional is part of your risk control, because if you're just surprised that something doesn't behave as you hoped, that's a risk.
Marty, yeah. to your point, if they're just following, not taking a risk and just following a benchmark, what's the point of keeping them?
Right. They have to make bets
because we're paying fees.
We need the outperformance.
Right.
Because we could buy a benchmark and have tiny fees versus their fees. So they have to make more outperformance than their fees. Mm-hmm. That's where you can just break even. And the fact is outperformance is not guaranteed. So you want some ratio of what I'm paying them versus their cost versus benefit. And it'd be nice to have two or three times more benefit than the cost. Mm-hmm.
Based on the relative rankings, you'd think they were a watchlist candidate. But if you look at the performance compared to the index, the 4 and the 5 year numbers are strong relative to the index. So we aren't recommending that you put them on watch at this point. Yeah. But we'll continue to watch them closely.
Yeah. Probably because the financial stocks in the last 5 years are in the tank, right? So they were light in those. So they did better in prior years.
Well, that was actually GMO. That was my GMO.
Okay, that was the prior one. Okay.
Yeah, they're gone. I think that they have a good investment team, but it's a common thing that I've seen in traditional managers to start building a portfolio from nothing to what the portfolio is you want to have, and then compare it to the benchmark, and you have to be really careful about the risks you take.
Regarding the benchmarks that you guys are choosing, are you choosing these benchmarks, or are these recommended by the managers or by the funds?
They're actually chosen in the asset allocation process. And okay. So then we'll look for a manager that would be outperforming that benchmark.
Okay. Because I know how...
There are cases where it's unclear which one, when we're starting through the... We're going out to hire a junk bond manager, and which benchmark are we going to use? Well, it depends to an extent what kind of the way the manager runs the portfolio. Mm-hmm. If they have a particular aspect of the market that fits them, and there's a benchmark that reflects that, that's probably a better comparison. Mm-hmm. If you can choose between a couple of them that are equally valid in terms of benchmark composition.
But you guys are making that decision independently of where to follow those funds?
When we start a search, we're looking to fill a particular spot, and there'll usually be a benchmark or two that works for that particular spot. Mm-hmm. And when we actually hone in on the particular manager that you hire, we'll take the way the manager actually runs its portfolio into account in choosing a benchmark, and staff is involved in that process as mm-hmm. well.
And short answer, have you ever seen someone manage their assets so much that they drift to another benchmark?
Sometimes someone will come and say, we think this is the appropriate benchmark. Benchmarks change as well. New benchmarks are introduced, and there can be, the manager of GMO came to us and said, well, we think you should use this benchmark. And we went through an analysis and we changed the comparable benchmark. And it happens.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, and you really want to listen to the manager too, because what are they trying to beat? You know, if they're trying to do something and you're expecting them to do something else, then you have potentially a mismatch.
But you need to be cautious about that, because if they say, hey, we're, you know, so many points above the S&P 500 when their assets are really based off something else, yeah. Then you know, they're just, it's all marketing. So anyway.
Yeah. Sometimes you want to be everything, because then there are more potential customers. So, well, we're benchmark agnostic.
There are some managers who very, J.P. Morgan would be one, who very carefully look at their benchmark and try to take very careful measured bets compared to their benchmark. So they're going to track that benchmark pretty closely. And then there are other people who say, I'm going to build the best portfolio I can and use whatever benchmark you want, and we suggest the S&P, or we suggest growth or value or whatever. And but they'll vary more, because they're looking at it. In this case, Lazard says, we don't like Japanese bonds, and we don't care that they're a big part of the benchmark. So they're taking active bets.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as that works, that's to your advantage. If it doesn't work, which it certainly hasn't on a relative to other peers' benchmark, then it's not a to your advantage.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you.
Mm. I just want to go back to Lazard. When we turn over to page 22 and you look at their performance after fees, you pretty much got to go back 4 years to get to where they beat the benchmark. And so I do have concern. And it's back to, you know, Will's point. The whole idea is that they're supposed to, we're paying them the extra fees to beat the benchmark.
Yeah, they got off to a fine start relative to the benchmark, and not so much lately.
Mm-hmm. And then the other one is the AFL-CIO. I mean, you've got to go back. Actually, you can go back 10 years. They've never beat the benchmark after fees.
Yeah.
But again, Deborah, when you're looking at that, it's always subject to that 10-point bias when you're looking at the trailing results. If you look at the year-by-year, there's certainly been periods in there where performance has been much more competitive. So it's accurate to say over the trailing 10 years as of March 31, they hadn't beat the benchmark. It's not accurate to say they've never beaten the benchmark over any period in there. So we always want to temper that with a year-by-year analysis.
Right, well, that's what I'm looking at, is 1 year through 7 years.
I mark it too, Deb.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Turn to gotcha. To page 27. Mm-hmm. And
so maybe this is just a bad quarter for them every year.
Right.
Okay, got it.
Whenever you have a really bad quarter, your entire history looks terrible. Whenever you have a really great quarter, your entire history looks great. So we have to say, you have to break that apart, and you can look at distinct periods. Calendar year is a great way to start. Try a rolling 3-year analysis, an even better way to say, you know, over some kind of meaningful time period, because 1 year is not a terribly meaningful time period. 3 years barely starts to get meaningful. It's frustrating from a trustee's perspective, but you know, these are long-term strategies. But yeah, and you take a look at page 27 to start.
But those are before fees, right?
Those would be before fees.
27, you say.
Oh, okay.
It's an interesting comment, and it's such a what have you done for me lately world, and the market judges that way. Every quarterly earnings report, right? I mean, it's all about what have you done lately, right now. But our perspective is
long term,
much longer term.
Right.
It's kind of a strange juxtaposition of two philosophies.
I mean, I would love the trustees when I looked at performance every 5 years, but that's not going to happen.
Section beginning on
what we would have to talk about for the other 4 years.
Yeah, that's the trust me approach, uh-huh. Right?
Section beginning on page 25. This is gross of fees. Is it possible to get this also in after fees?
Net of fees is before, isn't it?
For calendar?
The calendar.
Yeah, there's no calendar net of fees.
The calendar.
We could add that to the book. The book is as long as it is, but yeah, but if you'd like it, we could do that.
Will the font get smaller, Bob, if you do that?
No. So there'll be more pages in.
Yeah, a few more pages.
Struggling now.
What does the board want? Would we like to see it after fees?
I'd like to see it.
Yeah,
Do we need to see the annual after fees?
Well, do we need to see it gross of fees? Or what's more important to us, to see both or one or the other?
I'd rather see it net of fees.
Let's see. The peers are also gross of fees. Now, I think with our new system, we may be able to do peers net of fees, but comparing to peers net of fees is tricky because fees vary with size. So you could have a $10 million account, which would have a much higher fee than your $100 million account would.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we'll keep the gross and just go with adding the net of fees.
Yeah.
That's possible.
The relative performance then becomes a little tricky compared to peers. The peer numbers get flaky.
They aggregate mm-hmm. all of the accounts all don't together. Some are small accounts with higher fees.
I guess we wouldn't be looking for peer comparison in the net of fees.
You'll really be looking at the indexes.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Yeah, we'll get that in the next report. Should I move on to inflation hedges?
Yes, and that page is just to get there. It is 22 or page 17 and 22.
What's our page?
It's 17. So in the middle of 17 is the inflation hedge data. And this is versus a benchmark that's somewhat arbitrary. Yeah. Well, it's inflation plus 400 basis points. Perhaps. So it's appropriate, but these aren't going to track that quarter to quarter. But for the quarter, the PIMCO All Assets Fund gained 2.5%. The Wellington Total Return Fund gained 1.7%. And that compares to a 2.4% return for the CPI plus 4% benchmark. And then these are the funds that will be used to source the capital calls for Aether and Common Fund. Aether has a $75 million commitment. Common Fund has a $50 million commitment. Aether was funded in December, and it's reported with a one-quarter lag. So its name is in the report, but the data isn't in the report yet. Real estate is shown at the bottom of page 17. Overall, the real estate portfolio returned 8.8%.
Hang on just a sec. Going back, there's hardly any money in the common fund yet.
Yeah.
So don't get concerned about the performance.
Yeah. And it's mostly the effect of early fees. They don't have investments, but they're still charging fees. So that drags it down. Other than Atlante and Invesco, these are private real estate. Atlante and Invesco are public, but the others are private, so I'll discuss those separately. But Atlante was up 10.2% in the quarter versus a 10.1% benchmark. We discussed that briefly before. Invesco is the international REIT. They had a loss of 1.4% compared to their benchmark's loss of 1.3%, basically in line. And to look at the illiquid investments, it's page 20. And what I thought I'd do there is go over the changes versus last quarter for the gross returns, because that I think tells a bit of a story. So there are a few gross returns that were reported that were substantially different than last quarter. The first is Torchlight 4, which has a gross return of 17.5. Last quarter it had a gross return of 13.4, so substantial markup. LaSalle, now 3.2, had a minus 3.2 last quarter, so substantial markup. Oak Tree 6, 12.5 now, 9.5 last quarter. Singular Guff, 17.8 went down to 11.4.
So it's come up substantially.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's up. I think I said that backwards. The only one that went down was substantially was the Bay Area Equity Fund, which went down from the 30% annualized return to 24.7. So there's a lot of noise in that very high return stream. And the U.S. Power Fund 4.
Give me a it's been a long time since I've talked about Bay Area Active Fund. I know it was a small fund. Can you just, how much did we invest in it, and what are they doing? And just give me a short definition of what they do.
Yeah. Let me pull up the balance sheet here.
So we've got 30 million with them right now. Both funds.
Yeah, Bay Area Equity Fund is basically 31 million.
And it started on June of 04. And what's the time period?
Actually, that was you made a commitment of what, 10 million?
Yeah, that was the first
10 million back then.
The first one.
It's been a while.
We did two $10 million commitments, $10 million to fund one, $10 million to fund two.
So we're not talking big pieces of money.
When are we supposed to come out of it? What's the end date on it?
Fund one is winding down now.
Okay.
Fund two, we have another 4 years.
And they, what I remember is they invest in low-income housing in the Bay Area for real estate in the Bay Area?
No, it's a private equity fund. They invest in companies. They invested in Tesla.
Right.
They invested They invested in this company that makes healthy school lunches.
Okay.
And they invested in areas of the Bay Area that were maybe a little economically depressed. The idea being hiring.
Okay, but it has nothing to do with developments.
No, it's not a real estate thing.
In any kind of real estate way.
But there is a preference for companies that locate their headquarters or locate their staff in areas that are economically depressed.
So that's where I was getting that part, the connection of the lower income. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
So, I mean, for your own refreshment, Fund 1, the Tesla investment, returns the entire fund. One investment.
Got the whole thing.
Everything else is gravy. Fund 2, we're still in the earlier days there.
Okay.
And it used to be part of J.P. Morgan, and they split off when...
My recollection of them is they have a real eclectic mix of investments that didn't follow a singular kind of a pattern. They were kind of all over the place, at least the thoughts for Fund 2, I thought.
Yeah. Okay.
How can you have a gross of fees of 6.8% for Bay Area Fund 2 and then have a net of fees 17.2%?
That's actually a good question. And
are they giving us money?
No, it can relate to timing. Your money may have gone in at a different time than some of the other investors. That's we'll get back to you on that.
Yeah. I don't think it's negative fees. It's a bad business model for them.
It's good for us.
But those are all the comments I have, but can we answer any other questions?
So, excellent quarter.
Yeah.
Good job, Tim. So when does the correction come?
Good job, Marty.
Good job, Chichi.
Any day.
So it seems. I mean, there's a lot of chatter about it just because of, you know, equity valuations. It seems like people seem to think it's going to happen in 2014.
Well, we know we're not going to get when Marty was talking about good news, and he at the very beginning of the presentation, and he said, and the markets are up this enormous percentage. I thought, well, that's also bad news.
Right.
Markets are not as cheap as they once were. We're not recommending any change to your asset allocation at this point.
It's very difficult to make market calls.
And the market, at least the domestic equities market has sort of absorbed the Fed policy change, that we're not seeing the volatility associated with an announcement.
Yeah, it looks like interest rates are going to not spike anytime too soon, and that supports equities.
Okay. Any other questions, Bob and Marty? Do we have a motion to accept this report, or is that?
Yeah. So moved. Seconded.
Second. Okay. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstain? All in favor.
Thank you. Our first new vote under the new.
Actually, those are the rules. As my understanding, we may not fall under, but public agencies have to announce yes, no's, and abstentions.
Yes, we do.
No, yeah, so it's good.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good report, Marty.
I think.